Well, welcome back. This is the Taylor Report, and I am with, of course, Phil Conlon, and we're glad to see Phil because, you know, COVID keeps us all apart, and we miss being in the studio, but we're doing our level best, and we hope all, everybody's keeping safe. We were talking about, Phil, earlier, we were talking about this matter of the failure of progressives in the United States to do their job to oppose U.S. hegemony and to fight against the regime change concepts. And these are matters, by the way, and I want to give full credit to Tulsi Gabbard. She ran for the Democratic Party leadership and she made those her issues. And the Democratic Party really shunned her. And they are much more comfortable with AOC and Tlaib and Bernie than they were with Tulsi, because Tulsi really called into question the, and I think she used the word, regime change and imperialist philosophy behind the 800 foreign bases, military bases of the United States, the ships in all the corners of the globe, et cetera, which are, the old 19th century expression was gunboat diplomacy, and that's all it is. It's just that there are more gunboats. And it leads people in the United States Congress who claim to be progressives to signing on with gunboat diplomacy in order to say, oh, we gotta help the American people. Well, you know, that is exactly sort of a metaphor for our current pandemic issue. They're only interested in themselves first and only. They don't understand they're in a world with other people. And when you say, well, I want to get it more, I want to go get a $15 an hour wage, or I want to get a $2,000 payout. And the way I'll do that is I will attack China. I'll attack Vietnam. I will go for sanctions on Cuba. That way I'll be accepted. And that's the dues they pay. And therefore, they're really what they're, that line of thought is to tell the American people, we're going to be imperialists together, and but we'll look after our own. That's exactly upside down. The way to have peace, the way to get on and to have public health and all these things is to see yourself as part of a multilateral world, multinational world, and also members of the world bodies like the World Health Organization and the Paris Agreement on Environment or international agreements on limiting nuclear arms. All that has to be done in cooperation with other people. And if you're going to be saying, but I'm going to sanction those people, I'm going to insist that they adopt our type of economy, then you're not working with them, you're working against them. And you're doing it outside the law, frankly, international law, and you're doing it outside your own constitution. There is no, being a Canadian government does not mean that you can dictate to the Chinese government, and being the American government doesn't mean you can dictate to the Cuban government. But because it, after all, is founded, and these countries are founded on raw, violent colonialism, it's in the DNA of British and French, Spanish imperialism that they do have hegemony and they have the right to dictate. And it's deep in the psyche. And we have people calling themselves progressives who actually sign on with that. And this is a major psychological and political illness that is deep in our system. And we're going to have to change our ways. I'll give you a crosshead from a late New York Times. Here it says, just to underline my point, Beijing acted against the coronavirus with stunning force, as its official narratives recount, but not before a logjam had allowed a local outbreak to kindle a global pandemic. Now that's a flat out lie, and that's the New York Times. It's just been reprinted in the Globe and Mail. And I heard on CBC radio Dr. Aylward from the World Health Organization asked about that. And he said, that's wrong. He said that the Chinese medical reaction to the COVID-19 was exceptionally fast, actually. It is very rare that you have this type of outbreak and you identify the what it is, you identify the and break down the genome, and you lay out the steps necessary to contain it. To do that in a period going from late December 2019 to the first days of January is extraordinarily fast. And it was not, it was not done secretly. All information was shared through the World Health Organization and with the Centers for Disease Control around the world. So the American leaders responsible, the Center for Disease Control, knew in January, before there were any reported cases in the United States, knew all that it was necessary to know to fight the virus in the same way that the Chinese leadership and the Vietnamese leadership were fighting the virus and containing and defeating it, It was known. But the New York Times found that there was, they created a phony, you know, day count of 25 days. As Dr. Aylward said, that was extraordinarily fast. That wasn't slow. But the Times wants the same narrative, and the Democratic Party wants the same narrative as Donald Trump. That's the scary part. They're not going to say that. As a matter of fact, they're going to say, well, Donald messed up. But they were going to put responsibility on their named adversary, an adversary who does not agree to be an adversary. The Chinese leadership says it does not want any problems. They do not have any basis for an antagonistic relationship. The antagonism comes from Washington. And of course, Ottawa follows because Ottawa follows. That's what they do. They do as they are told. Now, but we have to fight on this because the political lines come from a foreign capital. And the Globe just reprints the New York Times. I don't know, the Toronto Star often does it. It's same with the television, everything else. It's our story is told to us by the United States. But its story is a lie. Most of the world, and the world subject to the world comes up a lot. Our foreign minister, Mr. Champagne, likes, oh, the world. But by the world, he means Five Eyes, the Anglo-American White Protestant Alliance, which is quite small and is imperialistic in its nature. They like to use the word world, but the world actually has been cooperating with the People's Republic of China, with Vietnam, and with Cuba, actually. The world didn't agree to beat up on Cuba. That was the United States. And the real task for Canadians is to get with the world, to try to escape from being under the thumb of operations such as the US-directed NATO and US-directed aggressive foreign policy. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT. I'm speaking with Phil Conlon. I'm sorry, Phil, I've been going on.
I don't think you can go on that subject enough. You know, it's like, You say that the Globe and Mail uses the New York Times. The Star uses the Associated Press. And you'll read some article in the Star, you'll say, boy, this is an ignorant article. They don't know nothing. And then you look and you say, oh, it's the Associated Press. So they've just like written off. They don't even want to bother to try to figure out what's going on. They just run an article that comes from the US and they say, here's the news. And yeah, that's what passes as a Canadian newspaper, you know.
And let's go back. Yes, a very good point. And why can't we take our leadership from Dr. Aylward in the World Health Organization?
Can who? No, they don't talk about them. Come on.
You know, I heard one, and I think it's the only one. It was a radio interview, a morning show, I think, one of the morning shows. I'm not absolutely sure. CBC with Aylward. Now, he's a bête noire, as you know. He is the Canadian Parliament has a committee on China, relations with China. They have basically subpoenaed him, to use the parlance of our time. It's not the word subpoena, but what they've said is he'll be called. They asked him to come, but he wouldn't come because there's two reasons. COVID-19, he has an important job, and he doesn't speak for, he's not the public relations or the public representative. He can be called upon for his area, but they're, frankly, the Canadian Parliament, including the NDP, thinks he should be basically called on the carpet to explain why they say nice things about China. And the difficulty for him is that he's only being objective. He's doing what he's got to, he says, you know, as a doctor and a specialist on the matter of virus, what's the best way to do, treat this matter, this crisis? And he said, they've been exemplary. You're not supposed to say that. And so the CBC actually is, while it was a semi-friendly interview, they bugged him as best they could, saying, oh, well, you know, didn't it take too long? Do you really believe the numbers? And he had a very nice point about the numbers. He said, well, you know, he spoke about the actual numbers as opposed to the conjectures in the Conservative Party or the back rooms of the NDP. He said, you know, they might be out. Nobody's numbers are exact, but you're talking about certain, you know, proportions. They might be out by 1,000, 2,000, one direction or the other, not necessarily in the larger, but maybe it's a smaller. But he says, you know, there's some precision, but you can't be absolutely certain until much later. He said, remember, you're talking about 2,000 versus 4,000 or 4,000 versus 6. He says, there's no question about their having conquered the virus. And in a country in which the numbers are 1.4 billion, and you're talking about the difference between 2 and 4 or 6 and 4. Meanwhile, Los Angeles is far worse than that. By any measure. So aren't we trying to talk about what is being done that caused those numbers to be low instead? But the CBC interviewer was afraid that maybe, you know, we were being too positive. It's just embarrassing. I don't know why I use that word. It's a maybe let's try for disgrace. That would do it. But we should be saying, since we are members of the World Health Organization, the United States quit. They walked away from it because it's led by a bunch of quitters. So what actually should be happening is that the Prime Minister should be calling directly to Dr. Aylward as a Canadian and congratulating him on his work and asking him for advice. But that can't be done because he has to be pilloried and mocked by people who have it in their DNA to raise issues of race, to be talking about, oh, those are Asian, those are Chinese. And we have a problem of racism slowly, and maybe not so slowly, growing during this pandemic, where talk like that coming from the New York Times and from this committee, and including articles in the Globe and Mail, which speculate on, can we trust the Chinese visitors? Can we trust the Chinese students? Can we trust Well, once you start that, you end up with putting people the way Canada did. They said, oh, we shouldn't have, you know, imprisoned the Japanese Canadians. You'd do it again in a heartbeat, frankly. Because if you have a leadership of bigots who won't overcome their own bigotry, who won't say, hey, this is dangerous talk, we should all be careful here. No. They all want to go on with this stuff and making it worse. That is, as this crisis continues, and particularly when we're in the zone of rationalizing the terrible conduct of our leaders in fighting the virus, there's going to be more and more offloading and trying to demonize those who fought the virus and did well. And so those are elements, anyhow, I believe need to be taken into account. Again, it's the Taylor Report. This is Phil Taylor. I'm with Phil Conlon. We can lighten the load here a little, Phil, by we said we're going to talk some about film. And who doesn't want to talk about movies? That's particularly in a time of when people are housebound. I saw the movie Mank. Did you see that?
Yes. We just watched Mank very recently. Very entertained by it. Very moved by it. It was, I thought, a wonderful picture of a very interesting moment in Hollywood's history, and also it was a good contrast between those who were trying to make a good movie and those who were trying to like control the message. And you know, sort of massage what was coming out. I was reminded that because the period it covers is the very beginning. When the silent era ends and the films begin. And there was a period of 1 or 2 years when there was none of the Puritanism, none of the censors, well, you can't say this, you can't say that, you can't show this, you can't show that. That didn't last very long, of course, because all the moral guardians of American society jumped into it. I wanna say that there was a depiction of the film of a Canadian, people forget that one of the M's in MGM, was Louis Meyer, who was from New Brunswick, and he was an awful SOB, and the film really, really showed, you know, what a ruthless, conscienceless, nasty piece of business he was. And of course, he's one of the legends of Hollywood, right? And we should remember that the legends of Hollywood, for the most part, were very nasty business people who were just there to make a buck, you know?
What do you know?
Yeah, surprise.
Yeah, you're quite right, of course. I thought the film had so many important things. Well, one, you have to start with Citizen Kane, because in thinking about it, Citizen Kane was a one-off. He didn't do that one again.
Nope. And it,
as we all know,
I mean, not even close, right?
The man was ruined. I mean, in the sense that they martyred themselves to make Citizen Kane. Orson Welles was a marked man, and this writer who would come to appreciate Mankiewicz was the script writer. And of course, they dramatized how he came to be to write this story, because he actually had close knowledge of. Herman J. Mankiewicz had close knowledge of William Randolph Hearst. So that's part of the story. But really, to my mind, you may as well make it into a tandem now. Because Kane tells the story of how capitalism creates media moguls who dictate issues. And the most famous, I think, striking moment in Kane, Citizen Kane, is when he sends a reporter to Cuba. He wants to war with Spain. He wants to capture Cuba, Hearst did. And he says, I want you to cover the war. And the reporter telegraphed back, well, I'm here in Cuba, but there's no war. And Kane said, telegram back, just send pictures, I'll provide the war. And that's the way it's done. If you talk about the invasion of Iraq, that's, you know, just hook something up. The New York Times, remember, helped, they beat the drum that there were weapons of mass destruction. And if one of their journalists staked her career on that. She's still got a career, but it's a very right-wing career, where they just lied, and then Iraq was bombed, and the media played its role. I thought that there was an opportunity in this, from this film, to talk about Bernie Sanders and the other reformers, but particularly Sanders, because, and it applies to Canada too, people who would like to see true radical reform or transformation to a socialist society. And they make the motivating moment for Mankiewicz in deciding to do the film or work on the film when he was threatened and told, you know, not to do it. But what he was, they make the motivating story, and it may not be actually be true, but it's a good technique in making this film. They show the campaign of Upton Sinclair for governor of California in 1934. It was called the End Poverty in California, the Epic Campaign. And Upton Sinclair was running as a socialist. He had been running as a socialist, but they convinced him to run as a Democrat. So, of course, first you have to get the nomination. Well, the Democratic Party laughed, thinking there was no way he'd get the nomination. Well, he got the nomination. He won that nomination by a huge margin. Then the ruling class of America and California realized they had a problem on their hands, because he said, I'm a socialist, but I am running on a campaign of reform in California to provide employment, to provide education, equality under the law for all Americans. And he set the place on fire, and it was extremely dangerous campaign. It was thought that he looked like he would win it. So Hollywood joined in, as they would, with Hearst, Louis B. Mayer, and more importantly, the Los Angeles Times, but that wasn't Hearst, that was the Otis family, I think. And they lied about Sinclair every day of the week. And in the case of Louis B. Mayer, he produced news reports, things posing as news reels, they called them, in which they interviewed people identified as from Oklahoma, and poor people and black people, saying they were going to support Upton Sinclair because he's going to give them everything. They just go to California and they don't have to work. And that was ghastly, and they got away with it. And that's in the film. And Mankiewicz is watching that in the film. And he is outraged. And it's when he resolves that he's going to fight these guys. I'm glad they put that in, because let's go back to Bernie. Bernie's a socialist, he says. He's from Vermont. I know people who on the left who say that they used to, when he was running for city council, they got more votes than he did. Because, you know, he hadn't been promoted anywhere, and he was just Bernie. But the problem of playing with capitalist parties like the Democratic Party or the Republicans, you think you're going to change them, and they're going to change you. And in the case of, we have to look at Upton Sinclair. Upton Sinclair, he learned his lesson. He wrote a book titled, I, Candidate for Governor, and How I Got Whipped. Beat, something like that. he pointed out that they asked him to run. He hadn't, it wasn't his idea. They asked him and he said, okay, I'll do it. But he, of course, thought that was, he learned his lesson. But there are those people who think, okay, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to change. And you end up like AOC and Tlaib and others. And pretty before you know it, you know, you go in saying you're going to change, you know, what's her name, Pelosi? And before you know it, you sound like Pelosi. If you want a taste of this, people should go to the Jimmy Dore program, and the Jimmy Dore and others are reacting to the failure of AOC and others to really behave like a block of people elected on a populist, put it that way, left populist platform, failure to take their lumps. You know, you have, they have enough votes to have been real trouble, but they instead are acting like loyal party guys now. And they could have made a stand on them on this issue of Medicare for all. And the idea was to force a vote. Phil, you would know from, you've been in many conferences and many conventions and all that, forcing a vote is, you don't always do that because you're going to win. You do that because you want everybody to put themselves on the record.
That's right. And you want to, let's find out clearly what the issue is here and who stands where on this issue and who, when it comes down to it, is just talking a line and who really thinks it's worth fighting for. And of course, sometimes you can be very unpopular for forcing a vote and say, well, come on now, you know, like Nancy asked you not to do that, right? And because you're going to make Nancy look bad. Well, you know, well, so be it. That's a look bad, right?
You were bumping to be on a committee. Now you won't be on the
committee. Right. And so AOC got punished. They didn't put her on the committee they wanted that she wanted to be put on. Now, supposedly, she's supposed to learn her lesson, right? So maybe
she did.
Other nonsense you talked about Tibet, maybe that was her way of saying, I'm so sorry, Nancy, I won't do it again. No. Which doesn't help, by the way, because Nancy will say, well, you know, what have you done for me today, right? But that, well, once they get you on that treadmill, there's no going back.
Yeah. One leads to the other. I've been at so many meetings where I've noticed it is a pleasure to be at these meetings over the years, all kinds of meetings, and where people are claiming that they're strongly with you and they pat you on the back and they agree with you. And then the terrible word goes up. They say, call the vote. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
excuse me, I have to go over to the other side of the room. So that's all they were doing. They weren't going to, it wasn't that they were going to do anything other than to say, this will be our starting point. Find out who's on side with us and who's not. Because, you know, when it comes to get elected, all of a sudden everybody's on your side. Oh yeah, I like your point there. I'm writing this down. I got my secretary. What's your phone number? We'll get back to you. And then they sell you down the river. And if you do that twice, you sold yourself down the river. Anyhow, that's Mank. I urge people to see it. And what you got to think about, in my opinion, is how that the campaign of Upton Sinclair and what it tells you about American political life. And for all these reformers who are now trying to operate the Democratic Party, that's a good study. This is the Taylor Report. I'm talking here with Phil Conlon. Phil, there's this other film called The Trial of the Chicago Seven. And I don't know if you've seen that one. We do our reviews by asking each other, we saw it. Did you see it?
Right. I haven't seen it yet because I know enough about the subject and I've heard it's a good film, it's a bad film. Of course, the stars of the film, as just like the stars of the actual trial, were some guys who were clowning around and thought that you could be a serious left winger by making a joke out of everything. And I wasn't impressed with them then. That's a long time ago. And so I haven't seen it. So I'll hold my opinion anyway. We're out of time. So We're out of time. We're out of time.
Absolutely so. Out of time. Well, okay, for the Taylor Report, for Phil Conlon, this is Phil Taylor, and we'll see you next week.